Smith. Maybe a couple of seconds and I will.
Hi, I'm Selwyn Manning and you are watching A View From Afar. And as always, we are joined by political scientist and former Pentagon analyst Paul Buchanan. And this week, we will discuss how nations that have a long history of trading with China are becoming intolerant to the People's Republic's covert influence operations. And specifically, we will discuss, why is China pursuing this 21st century of covert spying style of things with supposed trading allies? And how damaging are China's influencing operations amongst its Indo-Pacific trading partners? And how can independent Asia-Pacific states walk a tightrope where, on one hand, they progress two-way trade with China while ridding themselves of interference in their respective democracies and security intelligence engagements? But first, here's an invitation to those of you who are joining us live. If you are joining us via Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, feel free to make comments, and if you do, we'll be able to include your interaction in our program. So let's cross to Paul, who is waiting online to unpick the complexities of this very important issue. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Selwyn. Nice to be here.
This is a big issue, isn't it? A big topic. Yeah. And it's certainly influencing a lot of economies, a lot of people, and imposing challenges to people and their countries all over the world, but certainly specifically with respect to Indo-Pacific, or as many others call it, the Asia-Pacific region. So what do you make of this in the first instance, Paul, this influencing operations on the behalf of the People's Republic of China?
Oh, well, from their standpoint, they're a very, very effective tactic, part of the toolbox of statescraft that the Chinese employ. And you and I are very lucky because we're living in a country that has one of the foremost experts on Chinese influence operations, resident here, Anne-Marie Brady.
Anne-Marie
is controversial in some circles, disliked by the Chinese, but who's a very good scholar and has identified the so-called United Front operations that are not only exist here in New Zealand, but have become pervasive throughout the liberal democratic world.
And her work, for example, is been very big news in the United States and Australia, specifically in New Zealand too, of where she is based as a significant academic. And The Diplomat, for example, we just got up on screen. If people want to go a bit deeper into her work, where they can do so, and that's The Diplomat, the website where her work features significantly and can access from the front page. So thanks, Paul, for that.
Yeah. How about we do this? Let's put this in some context so that the viewers understand exactly where influence operations sit in, you know, the range of things that nations can do as part of their statescraft. And what I'd like to do is mention the subject of strategic corruption. Now, I'll make it quick. There is petty corruption, which is where you pay a traffic cop $10 so you get out of a speeding ticket. There is bureaucratic corruption, where you have to pay a bribe in order to get a driver's license or a permit to add an extension to your house. There is what is known as grand corruption, which is a little bit of an exaggeration, but where, for example, a firm will pay an economics minister or a minister of industry in order to secure a contract against, you know, more legitimate competitors. But now we have this phenomenon of strategic corruption. And this is where states use corruption as an element of statescraft. In fact, as a substitute for more, you know, violent or more covert methods of influence. And what it's designed to do is penetrate the political and corporate fabric of a targeted society, in most cases a liberal democracy, because in many authoritarian regimes, corruption is endemic. I mean, that's just the way you do business. But in liberal democracies, we don't do that as a matter of course. And the idea is to influence the decision-making elites of these countries in a direction that is favorable to the state that is engaging in strategic corruption. And the absolute experts at this, using influence operations, are the People's Republic of China, and then to a lesser extent, but influential in their own right, are the Russians, who also engage in this game. And if you think about it, Selwyn, if you can corrupt the politics and the corporate decision-making of a rival state, you're weakening it from within. You're bending it to your will without having to fight it. So it's a brilliant strategy if you can get away with it. And quite frankly, the PRC in our neck of the woods has gotten away with it quite a bit, although now the pushback has begun, led by the Australians, and we'll see if a new era is about to dawn.
Well, let's have a look at what the Australians have been kind of facing and also bringing out of the shadows, if you like, where a lot of countries like New Zealand has been reticent to actually shine a light on activities publicly of what may have been going on, most likely has been going on in New Zealand as well. But let's have a look at some of the stuff that the Australians are doing by way of its mainstream media, I must say. So first off, up the ranks here, we've got this piece from ABC.
In Australia, it is clear that the Chinese Communist Party is working to covertly interfere with our media, our universities, and also influence our political processes and public debates.
Last year, in response to a scandal over Chinese Communist Party influence in Australia, the federal government passed sweeping new laws banning foreign interference in Australian politics.
We consider that the potential for foreign interference and foreign influence in our democratic system to be of such a high level of concern that it motivated us to totally redraft the laws so that we had the full suite of powers to police these real concerns.
Despite this, there's evidence that covert Chinese Communist Party interference is continuing.
Why are people afraid?
Because of repercussions from the Chinese consulate or the Chinese government.
We've had multiple briefings at the top secret level from ASIO and other agencies that foreign interference is being conducted in Australia at an unprecedented level.
So Paul, this is illustrating and applying basically what you've alluded to here. So what do you make of the Australian experience here, considering that Australia is a significant trading partner with China and has a free trade agreement, a bilateral free trade agreement with China, and also engages within the region on regional trade block type of trade arrangements like we've seen, multilateral ones like the RCEP that we talked about in the last episode. And yet China is continuing and has clearly a covert operation of which is extremely deep in the Australian fabric, its society itself. Let's get to those questions that we presented to our viewers at the front end of this. Why is China adamant that it needs to do this kind of thing? And I say adamant that it needs to because the effort of which it is advancing these covert operations is beyond what perhaps we have seen since the Cold War times between Soviet interference in so-called Western-leaning democracies.
Well, I think the short answer is that China is playing catch-up still playing catch up economically and in issues of trade. And so it is using this sort of methodology in order to obtain favors, to be granted access, that sort of thing, that otherwise would take much longer to achieve. And then the personal ambitions of President Xi, he clearly sees himself in messianic terms. He's not a reformer, you know, he's not anything like any of his predecessors since Mao Zedong passed away. And so he has serious ambitions. He has virtually unbridled power, and he's shown, you know, a propensity to use it. That may be personal hubris, and it may be his undoing eventually. But the combination of trying to play catch up and a president who's willing to stop at virtually nothing short of war in order to achieve these grand national objectives, I think, is what's behind all of this. And the difference is stark. You know, we know that intelligence agencies, as a matter of course, in the human intelligence field, they use bribery. They use things like honey traps in order to leverage people. Blackmail is just one of the tools that intelligence agencies will use in order to gain information from important individuals in targeted states. But if to use a trite phrase, this is like a whole of government approach, in that the whole point of influence operations is to not only change the mindset of politicians and corporate elites, but to change the mindset of society as a whole in a direction that is more favorable to the interests of the state that's engaged in this type of strategic corruption known as influence operations.
And this influencing operations, for example, with Australia, we are seeing now coming out into the public sphere evidence of how deep into the legislature in Australia that the Chinese have probed. I'll just very quickly, before we go on to that next point, just illustrate that with some coverage once again, coming from 60 Minutes this time.
Tonight, more this was extraordinary in details about
28th of
China
June,
is plotting to interfere in Australia's political system. On Friday, I watched astonishing scenes of federal agents under the direction of ASIO raid the home of New South Wales Labor MP Chiquette Mosselmain. This is the first time in this country's recent history a politician has been so actively investigated about whether he's been influenced by a hostile foreign state. Now, make no mistake about the seriousness of this operation. The agents know what they're looking for, and if they find it on phones or laptops, the consequences will be far-reaching, both here and in Beijing.
Yeah. So that's obviously laying it out pretty broadly and, very succinctly, I should say, Paul, isn't it? From the point of view of the risks that the individuals actually pose to themselves, their own livelihood, their own liberty, should they have gone over the line, crossed that Rubicon, if you like. Here in New Zealand too, you know, and the work of Anne-Marie Brady is obviously broad it out in fine detail, but there are question marks around the two main parties, the Labor Party, which is in government now, but more significantly, the National Party, had an MP perhaps that was under the spotlight for quite a sustained time, particularly from the public point of view, of being concerned that his ties to the CCP were too close, that he had actually benefited in the past personally from obviously being a Chinese national, but also educated under their guise, and then comes to New Zealand. He's an academic at the University of Auckland and then ends up a significant MP within the National Party at a time where the National Party was in power under John Key. So with that, do you think that those assessments that were in the public sphere with respect to the man and individual I'm talking about were fair? Because I understand that when you're an academic at Auckland University as well, you basically knew him personally.
Oh, yes, I knew him. Actually, I knew him quite well, and he was a very good colleague. I think, though, and it goes to show you the success of the Chinese government in placing people in strategic positions. because this individual, you know, was in Parliament for 9 years, plus was on various committees. My understanding is that there were concerns about him raised by the intelligence services relatively early on, and so he was kept off the Intelligence and Security Committee. He was kept off committees that involved issues of defense. But nevertheless, you know, he's listening to the small talk. And that's the important part here is, well, it's twofold. There are two important things. The first one is that the corruption is not just lining people's pockets with money. That undoubtedly occurs. But imagine situations where people of influence, let's say former party presidents, now retired, former MPs who had a certain stature who are now retired, imagine situations where they're placed on the boards of Chinese companies or Chinese companies, mixed ventures with New Zealand or Australian companies, and they're told they don't have to do anything other than talk to their former colleagues, and for that they'll get $500,000. You know, it's very clear what that's designed to do, but it's not, you know, the simple payment of bribes under the table. And then, of course, there's access through family members.
Just on that, I mean, there's no evidence that any New Zealand MP of any persuasion or state of origin ever received any bribes. I'm just making that clear, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. But on the other hand, there are a number of individuals, prominent individuals, mostly on the national, so center-right side of the ledger, who, lo and behold, have been discovered to hold positions in companies and entities that have a strong Chinese component to it, and they don't appear to do anything other than shake hands and introduce their Chinese counterparts to their New Zealand friends. Maybe it's all innocent, maybe it's not. But the second part of this, and mentioning my former colleague was worthwhile in that regard, is both in Australia and here in New Zealand, but also elsewhere in the Southwestern Pacific, the finger of blame immediately gets pointed at Chinese people, that is Australian Chinese citizens, New Zealand Chinese citizens, whether or not they came from the mainland and whether or not they were born in New Zealand, they could be second generation. But we tend to jump to the conclusion that the loyalties of Chinese New Zealanders and Australians are divided and that when push comes to shove, they will side with their motherland rather than their adopted country.
So are you raising
here's my point.
You're raising an issue it's New Zealand nationals that were born, bred New Zealanders, for example, if we're narrowing the scope down to that, that are more dangerous to the country's national interests than the other, the alternative.
You anticipated what I was going to say. The fact of the matter is, as the clip of the politician in New South Wales shows, it's not the immigrant Chinese who are necessarily the biggest threat when it comes to influence operations. It's the native-born white politicians, corporate actors who readily accept these overtures from the PRC, you know, again, exchange for favors and exchange for money.
Or a sense of privilege in being a part of the action. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. And that, I think, is something that is a bitter pill for both Australians and Kiwis to swallow, to know that some of our preeminent figures may be playing loose with their honesty in order, you know, to get a few rubles from the Chinese, to mix metaphors. You know, is really hard to swallow, but nevertheless, it's a fact. And again, the work of Anne Marie Brady has been very conclusive on this, because she traces the corporate, you know, connections, you know, the people who are on boards. And let's just say, when it comes to New Zealand, there are far more Pakeha, white New Zealanders, represented in these clearly sinecure type positions than any Chinese Kiwi.
So how damaging and how dangerous is this type of influencing operation or operations to the national interest, to even the public interest? of any state. But if we're looking at Australia and New Zealand, how damaging is it, these influencing operations by way of the People's Republic of China?
Well, I mean, very clearly, if you can weaken your adversary or influence the way the adversary thinks in a direction favorable to yourself before having to confront him or her in the physical plane, then it's certainly worthwhile doing, and it's a threat to the targeted country. Let's think of it this way. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that Chinese influence operations in New Zealand and amongst the smaller island countries of the South Pacific is oriented, among other things, to get us to side with the Chinese when it comes to the South China Sea disputes with China's neighbors and the United States. Let's say if they work the politicians, if they work society as a whole, using disinformation and propaganda, but putting out their version of events in the strongest manner, yet subtle manner possible, they could get the country to begin to shift its opinion about who is right when it comes to the territorial claims made by China against all of its neighbors and the United States. If they're able to do that, then the opposition to Chinese island-building projects in the South China Sea begins to erode. The public will not support policies that confront the Chinese. That will percolate up into the electoral cycle, and politicians who continue to maintain a hard line on China when it comes to their territorial claims may in fact start to lose elections.
So
and
it go-
will be re- so and they'll go- be replaced by people who are more amenable to the Chinese view of things.
And
take
so you,
any
you're,
range of subjects.
You're looking
take any
at
any range of subjects. And
you look,
you'll
but
see.
You look just on that point. You know, you're bringing into play that it goes beyond the trade self-interest. It goes to the point where you lose your independent voice in representing the nation of which has elected you. And at that point, you become covertly a satellite state of the People's Republic of China. So it goes beyond that trade self-interest, I suppose, is what I'm talking about. And that's the danger, isn't it, that we can then see it being put into play, that the whole thing is broken down from within, not through the persuasiveness of dialogue or argument or even...
No, and look at your... Yeah. Your point is very good with regards to trade, because one of the axioms of trade is that for countries to mutually benefit bilaterally or multilaterally, each of them will have to make concessions. That is, nobody's going to get everything they want. Everybody will get something of what they want. The Chinese do not play by those rules. The Chinese use their influence operations to sway their interlocutors in the other countries in their direction so that they wind up being disproportionately benefited or favored by their trade deals.
Now, and Hong Kong's government at the time, at this very moment, I should say, where you've got the Prime Minister coming out and basically saying she is very comfortable with the People's Republic of China's establishing moves toward the legislature in Hong Kong by way of, you know, acts that have been forced upon them, meaning acts of legislation.
What's interesting, I would imagine there are academics who look at this, but if you look at the trade deals that were signed by China and Australia and New Zealand in the early 2000s, those deals are a different nature. They are more reciprocal. They are more mutual beneficial, yes. Precisely because even though there was the size asymmetries between China and its two Southern Hemisphere partners, there was a common logic, if you will, a trade logic amongst that crowd of Chinese trade negotiators.
And it was to progress two-way trade. And we saw the evidence and the benefit of that in New Zealand, and Australia has as well. So just to
Now, in the 2010s and now 2020, trade is viewed as another weapon in the Chinese arsenal.
And we saw that last week.
Yes. If you look at the Belt and Road initiatives, these are very contingent. These are conditioned on things of benefit to the Chinese in a way that we didn't see even 10 years ago. So something has changed. And what part of that change is that now the Chinese are engaging in these influence operations in a measure that they weren't just 10 years ago. I mean, it started up a while ago, but it is now it's a full-fledged operation.
And from the point of security intelligence, Anne-Marie Brady's work seems to underscore what she is presenting there, that New Zealand amongst the Five Eyes nations, the intelligence network of which we share benefit with the United States, Canada, the UK, Australia and New Zealand, that New Zealand is the weak link in that chain, in that network, and that the influencing of China actually exposes that weak link. Now, just park that there. And last week on the RCEP trade block multilateral agreement had only just been signed. As they would say, the ink has hardly even dried on the paper. And China has a go at New Zealand. And on the back of that is referring to Five Eyes, the spy network, the intelligence network of which those Western-leaning nations enjoy, and saying about plucking the eyes out. Mm. So we are seeing materializing exactly what you have crafted out in the past, where trade interests and security interests do not align well when they're not shared by common players, if I can define
and values.
It that way. And values.
I mean, and values. The interesting thing, I think we've talked about this in the past, but there's a big difference between Australia and New Zealand when it comes to the ability to push back on the Chinese.
Yeah.
I mean, let's remember that not only is the Australian economy much, much larger than New Zealand's, but they have strategic minerals that the Chinese need, absolutely need, strategic minerals.
Yeah, those commodities that China needs to actually realize its development goals in the next 10 years, let alone 20. Yeah.
Precisely. Now, New Zealand has no such thing. We have dairy products and forestry and fisheries, all of which can be easily cut off without the growth of the Chinese economy being appreciably affected other than in the consumer industries. And therein lies the rub. New Zealand is the weak link. It's the weak link economically. We can be, you know, the Chinese sneeze, we catch the flu. You know, their ability to reach out and touch us in a harmful way is far greater than in the case of our Five Eyes partners. And they will punish us in trade, our economic lifeline, since China's now New Zealand's biggest trading partner, for reasons that have nothing to do with trade, such as Hong Kong. All New Zealand did was join a joint declaration by the Five Eyes partners that the usurpation of democracy in Hong Kong, 25 years before the devolution date, Hong Kong's supposed to be returned in 2045, not 2020, and yet de facto it has been absorbed by mainland China, by the PRC, against the will of its citizens. So
those criticisms by way of the Five Eyes network statements is what China was objecting to. There are some that are picking up, for example, that the new New Zealand government led by Jacinda Ardern, the Labour-led government with its decisive win in the elections this year, that in October, that there is a different type of expression relating to its concerns about China's influencing operations. And it's coming through in some of the news reports on it, where the tool that New Zealand is using is now ambiguity, as opposed to the silence of acceptance. And it seems that diplomatically, the Chinese are picking that up and seeing that as the beginning of something of which they don't wish to tolerate.
It's interesting that it's gone, you know, between the Australians and New Zealanders, it's gone in different directions. In the past, Australia remained ambiguous about influence operation on its own shores. Now, it's open in its condemnation and pushback. In the past, under the previous national government, the national government basically denied that there was any problem with Chinese influence.
And it enjoys a massive vote from those Chinese that have chosen to live in New Zealand.
Chinese New Zealanders. But National had nothing to say when the reports of influence operations in New Zealand politics, takeovers of New Zealand companies and joint ventures, when all that started to come out heavily in the early 2010s, National was in power and it had nothing to say about it other than good things. The Labor government has now turned to this policy of ambiguity, and if I may stretch the comparison a wee bit, and as you well know, I grew up in Latin America. Spanish is one of my languages. In Spanish, there's a saying that sometimes what is not said carries more weight than what is said. And I think that's what the Ardern government is trying to get across to the Chinese, that we may be small, but the United States looks to be on the rebound after the Trump interregnum. Our European partners are now pushing back at Chinese influence operations. See, we're not the only part of the world where they've put out and
Africa.
Africa's, you know, that's off the charts.
It is off the charts, but you're talking the EU bloc. Yeah.
The EU. Yeah, I mean, there is a concerted pushback. It's one of the things where I think there may be some miscalculation, if not within a larger CCP circles, with certainly within President Xi's inner circle, because his aggressive moves on the world stage have created an almost global defensive alignment against the PRC, precisely because it's pushing too hard. So I think that Ardern is subtly signaling to the Chinese that not only are New Zealand and its partners aware of the extent of their sharp power, their influence operations, their use of strategic corruption, but that we, along with our partners and allies, will begin to resist it, including over issues of human rights. I mean, mind you, something has to be said about the genocidal treatment of the Uyghurs. You know, we can no longer sit by, small or big, and allow this to continue, because the precedent, if nothing else, can be disastrous in places that have ethnic violence, conflicts of those sorts. And so I have a feeling that we're on the cusp of a renewal, I wouldn't say of the Anglophone's security system, but of the Western-centric security system against what they consider to be the more egregious behavior on the part of Chinese, and as I've said before, the Russians in certain instances,
if we look at,
on all dimensions.
If we look at that, then what can particularly countries like Australia, New Zealand, and on behalf of perhaps other Polynesian-leaning Pacific Island states, what can those kind of countries, led by Australia perhaps as the regional power here, what can they actually do to counter this Chinese influencing operations at a most serious level? We've seen the Australians kicking back and bringing the media into the fold, operations of which to try and identify those that have been compromised within its legislature. Is that the kind of thing that you see, or is there a point where these countries actually band together and say enough's enough diplomatically, the consequences bringing them on?
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, the small island nations of the Pacific Island Forum cannot do anything against the power of the Chinese. With their checkbook diplomacy and other more covert means, the Chinese have basically swamped the South Pacific with their influence operations. They can't do anything individually, and even as a group, the Pacific Island Forum is too vulnerable to the Chinese. However,
many times that we've seen, particularly in Melanesia and also in Tonga, where the populations have become intolerant to the Chinese influence on its elected leaders. In Tonga, for example, I witnessed it firsthand, the burning down of 80% of its capital, Nuku'alofa, And the whole 80% of that capital was considered a crime scene, of which, when it boiled down to it, what would happen was the targeting of Chinese buildings was most prominent. And it was
clear. Right, it was Chinese businesses that were being targeted. But here's what I would say, Selwyn, because you've alluded to it. There is discontent against Chinese influence amongst the populations of these states. I think what we need to do, I say this as, you know, an Anglophone myself, we have to turn the concept of united front on the Chinese themselves. And whereas they use it to show, use front organizations for influence operations in liberal democracies, the united front concept, as I'm using it here, is a united coalition led by Australia and the South Pacific, seconded by New Zealand, including the Pacific Island Forum nations, where we develop standards of transparency and cohesion with regards to, for example, economic relationships with China. Anyway, present the Chinese with a united front when it comes to these sort of things. Say, look, we'll trade with you, and we're independent states, even though we're small. But when you start putting money into the pockets of our politicians, when you start spreading propaganda and disinformation because you want something out of our societies, let's say recognition or non-recognition of Taiwan. We've just seen a major stoush in the Solomons and Vanuatu about recognition of Taiwan versus the PRC.
Yeah.
And on those measures, I believe that it is possible to turn the tables on the Chinese as a collective. See, in numbers there is strength when confronting such a large power such as China.
How would it respond?
Individually, we'll be divided and conquered.
Yeah, I get that. And how do you anticipate China would respond should it be presented with that united block of resistance?
Well, they're still an they're an immature imperial power. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that China is a neo-imperial power. You know, it's not quite the colonialism, you know, back in the day of previous centuries, but it's acting like an imperial power, but it's immature. And the immaturity is shown when it lashes out like it did towards New Zealand about Hong Kong. We're going to, you know, poke you in the eye, you five eyes. Threats. They immediately escalate to threats and retaliation. I have no doubt that will happen in the event that a united anti-united front or anti-corruption front is presented to them in the South Pacific. But there's a lot in the South Pacific that they're interested in and that they need in some instances, be it fisheries, be it access to the sea lanes of communication that connect the Western and the Eastern Pacific basins. And so it is possible that if we can weather the initial storm of threats and retaliation as a group, that then the Chinese themselves will have to back off, because over the long term, they'll be cutting off their nose to spite their face.
On that point, Paul, let's wrap this program up. Thanks very much for joining us. And to those that have joined us live, really appreciate your company. And if you're seeing it on demand, do join us live next week. That would be fantastic to have you included. And in between that time, thank you and take care.